This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Charlie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charlie.
Everyone else, good morning. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our presentation this morning of the New York Times Sunday Opinion section on today, the 28th day of April, 2024. I'm Howard Tankersley, along with
Tom Davis.
And Tom will lead us off with our first piece.
This is an opinion piece by opinion columnist Ezra Klein. A close examination of the most infamous public toilet in America. On a recent sunny Sunday, residents of San Francisco's Noe Valley gathered to celebrate the opening of a toilet. But not just any toilet. This was the nation's most infamous public toilet. In 2022, my colleague Heather Knight, then at the San Francisco Chronicle, noticed the projected price tag on the commode, $1.7 million, which Assemblyman Matt Haney had secured from the state. This was business as usual in San Francisco. Other public toilets had cost about the same. Local officials were planning a celebration. But Knight's article set off a furor. Governor Gavin Newsom clawed back the money. The party was canceled. Haney denounced the project he had made possible. "This is insane. The process is insane. The amount of time it takes is insane." He wanted answers. Phil Ginsberg, the general manager of San Francisco's Recreation and Parks Department, responded with a letter that is a masterpiece of coiled bureaucratic fury. He told Haney that the department had been pleasantly surprised by the unexpected allocation of $1.7 million for the Noe bathroom. "Until now," Ginsberg wrote, "we have not received any questions from you on the estimate." But Ginsberg was happy to walk Haney through the numbers and describe how Haney, as a former member of San Francisco's powerful Board of Supervisors and a current member of the state legislature, bore responsibility for them. "As you will see, the process is indeed long and expensive," he noted. "It is also the result of many years of political choices and exacerbated by skyrocketing costs. There's the planning and design phase, which requires bringing the design for the public toilet to community engagement stakeholders and refining it based on their feedback. That typically takes 3 to 6 months. Then the Public Works Department can solicit bids from outside contractors. That takes 6 months. Construction takes 4 to 6 months more, depending on whether a prefab toilet is used or one is constructed on site. The toilet also needed approval from the Department of Public Works, the Planning Department, the Department of Building Inspection, the Arts Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, the Mayor's Office on Disability, and PG&E, the local electric utility. "I share your frustration and concern over the length and costs associated with public construction processes," Ginsberg wrote. "As an elected official, I hope you will advocate for policy changes at the state and local level to make it easier to move small projects like this one." He offered some suggestions. The building code could be rewritten to make it easier to purchase and install prefabricated structures. Under the terms of a project labor agreement approved by the Board of Supervisors during your tenure, we are restricted from using off-site modular construction for any project using bond funds in excess of $1 million, he acidly noted. The Board of Supervisors could eliminate multi-agency approvals for small projects. It could streamline the bidding process. it could lift the boycott it had placed on doing business with 30 other states on account of their laws on reproductive, voting, and LGBTQ rights. Now the press and the public were watching. It turned out Ginsburg was right. Different choices could be made, and those choices could save money. The city now estimates that the Noe toilet cost only around $200,000. Somehow this is yet more maddening. If San Francisco can install public toilets for $200,000, why doesn't it do so normally? In this case, the low price misleads. Vaughn Buckley, the chief executive of Pennsylvania's Volumetric Building Companies, saw an opportunity to dramatize the high cost of building around the country and the ways modular structures can cut those costs. He brought in his friend, Chad Kaufman, chief executive of the public restroom company in Nevada, to donate a modular toilet, and Buckley provided the engineering and labor to install it. Even so, the timeline galls. The restroom, which cost around $120,000, was already built. The installation, which Buckley estimates at around $140,000, took a week and a half. The back and forth on procurement, logistics, permitting, not to mention whether San Francisco would even accept a donation from Nevada, one of the states it was boycotting, took about a year. It should not take a year to have an already built toilet put in the ground, Buckley told me. Perhaps San Francisco is changing. Last April, the Board of Supervisors voted 7-4 to repeal the boycott on politically wayward states. It's not achieving the goal we want to achieve, Supervisor Raphael Mandelman admitted. Mayor London Breed proposed reforms meant to make sure a debacle like the Noe toilet never happens again. They are, to my eye, modest. Breed would allow city agencies to band together when purchasing construction services and goods for projects under $5 million and remove the Arts Commission review for projects under $1 million. The mayor's office says that even this set of reforms took 2 years to craft. These things take time, her spokesman Jeff Creighton told the Chronicle. If coordinating among multiple agencies and interest groups is costly and time-consuming when building a single toilet, imagine what it's like when trying to curb their power. But it's not just San Francisco. Buckley, the modular construction CEO, told me he jumped into the Noe toilet mess because he thought it a striking metaphor for a general problem. It's really easy to sling mud at San Francisco and say it's such an outlier, he said. But these same challenges occur throughout the country for very similar reasons, and they don't get the time of day. The problem, he said, is that regulation is usually the consequence of punishment. It is there to prevent something bad from happening, not to make something good happen. To me, this is not a discussion about San Francisco or Rec and Parks, who I think are doing a great job. They are by no means alone in the challenges they face. If these problems recur across cities and states, I asked him, is there a single solution that would solve them? People able to stand in the way of legislation that doesn't make sense and remove it for that reason. We think of adding regulation as something liberals do and removing regulation as something conservatives do. But what regulation often does is take power and discretion away from government employees who could do a far better job if they were allowed to make decisions based on goals rather than process. I still find myself thinking about the most unusual part of Ginsburg's letter. He included a line in bold, italicized type, making clear that the problem was even worse than the public thought, even worse than Haney was suggesting. Our restroom building costs are consistent with the inflationary pressures on all San Francisco public works projects. He didn't want to build this way. He wasn't given a choice. This moment was a rare opportunity to change that. And if Breed's proposed reforms are anything to judge by, it's not going to change it by much. But plenty of other cities have the same problems. In the ones with healthy media outlets, we even know about them. For instance, if any New Yorkers are feeling smug about San Francisco's travails, allow me to direct your attention to 5 small and quite ugly public toilets that sell for $185,000 each and that the city estimates could cost more than $5 million to install.
Tom, thank you. Justin Trudeau is no match for a polarized world. By Stephen Marsh, the author most recently of The Next Civil War. Political careers often end in failure, a cliche that exists because it too often happens to be true. Justin Trudeau, one of the world's great progressive leaders, may be heading toward that moment. In a recent interview, he acknowledged that every day he considers leaving his crazy job as Canada's prime minister. Increasingly, the question is not if he will leave, but how soon and how deep his failure will be when he goes. At stake is something that matters more than one politician's career: Canada's contemporary, liberal, and multicultural society, which just happens to be the legacy of the Prime Minister's father and predecessor, Pierre Trudeau. When you fly into Montreal, you land in Trudeau Airport, and that's because of Pierre, not Justin. The threat to that liberal tradition is not all Justin Trudeau's fault, of course. The right-wing tide overwhelming global politics has come late but with pent-up vigor to Canada. For several years now, polls have shown Mr. Trudeau's Liberals at lows from which no Canadian political party has ever recovered in elections. In a recent by-election, in a key suburban district of the Greater Toronto Area, the Conservative Party beat the Liberals by a lopsided 57% to 22%, a swing of 9 percentage points to the Conservatives. But polls and by-elections can be poor predictors of election viability. A better indicator is the flummoxed figure of Mr. Trudeau himself, who seems increasingly out of touch in the new world of division and extremism. Part of Mr. Trudeau's problem is simple exhaustion, both his own and Canadian voters. He has been in government for almost 8.5 years. During that time, he has been one of the most effective progressive leaders in the world. His government cut Canada's child poverty in half. He legalized marijuana, ending roughly 100 years of nonsense. He made large strides in reconciliation with Indigenous Canadians. He renegotiated NAFTA with a lunatic American president. He handled COVID better than most. You don't have to squint too hard to recognize that he is one of the most competent and transformative prime ministers this country has ever produced. But an era has passed since the start of that halcyon time when Mr. Trudeau stood in front of his first cabinet and, when asked why it was half female, answered, "Because it's 2015. Now a new generation has emerged, for which the liberal technocratic order his government represents has failed to offer a path to a stable, prosperous future, and the identity politics he once embodied have withered into vacuous schism. The growing anti-liberal party sentiment of young people is the biggest threat to his electability." His opponents are well aware of Mr. Trudeau's unpopularity with young voters and have focused conservative attacks on an issue especially important to that cohort, the housing crisis. The soaring real estate market, in which tiny homes in Toronto and Vancouver now regularly cost more than properties in Paris or New York, has been exacerbated by the Trudeau government bringing in over 1 million immigrants last year without having built the necessary infrastructure to support the communities receiving them. For decades, Canada has been the only country in the world where the more patriotic citizens are, the more they support immigration. Liberal mishandling of immigration's impact may well end this blessed state. The housing crisis is the epitome of Mr. Trudeau's failure. It feels good, it feels righteous to support immigration. Isn't that the whole idea behind multiculturalism? But without the proper hard-headedness, without being frank about difficult realities, righteousness quickly sours. The first evidence of the Prime Minister's weakness in the face of Canada's growing polarization was the government response to the so-called Freedom Convoy of 2022, in which anti-vaccine demonstrators held Ottawa hostage for a month. His government decided to take a bureaucratic approach to the disruption, dithering while the truckers entrenched themselves in the city, then using the Emergencies Act to seize several of their bank accounts. A January federal decision found that Mr. Trudeau's invocation of the act was not justified. Other countries took much simpler approaches to their civil unrest in the aftermath of COVID restrictions. The French used tear gas. The moment a convoy set out from Los Angeles headed for Washington, in imitation of the Canadian convoy, the Biden administration called out the National Guard. Other countries know there is a time for brute force. The same fear of confrontation, which, to be fair to Mr. Trudeau, afflicts the entirety of Canadian culture and politics, motivated new online harms legislation, which he proposed in February in an attempt to regulate or at least somewhat contain the interest in social media from revenge pornography and child sexual abuse material to hate speech. It is, unfortunately, an absurd document that seeks to impose virtue by fiat. The maximum penalty for promoting genocide, a form of speech crime, is life imprisonment, meaning harsh punishments can be meted out for the vaguest and most subjective of definitions. Equally troubling is the measure that if a Canadian citizen fears on reasonable grounds that a hate crime will be committed, the individual can apply for an order that another person be subjected to court-mandated conditions on what that person may say. No less a figure than Margaret Atwood described the proposed law as Orwellian. "It's letters to cachet all over again," she wrote on X, referring to the king's ability in pre-revolutionary France to imprison without trial. The spirit behind the new law is the very worst of Canada. Be nice or else. And it will do nothing to contain the disinformation wave that's swelling. But more than any other event, it is the October 7 attack on Israel by Hamas that has exposed Mr. Trudeau's inability to fight for liberal values. Since that day, the Canadian Jewish community has been subject to violence not seen since the 1930s. A synagogue has been firebombed, a Jewish school shot at, a Jewish hospital targeted by an anti-Semitic mob, a Jewish-owned bookstore vandalized, a Jewish neighborhood disrupted, a Jewish grocery store lit on fire. A mob outside a Holocaust museum in Montreal chanted, "Death to the Jews." Mr. Trudeau's response has been pleas for everyone to just get along. "This needs to stop," he said, referring to the lobbing of a Molotov cocktail at a synagogue. "This is not who we are as Canadians." This litany of failures is all the more significant because of Mr. Trudeau's name. At a moment of crisis for Canadian multiculturalism, he makes a poor contrast with his father. Pierre Trudeau was not just another Canadian politician. He passed the Charter of Rights and Freedoms while establishing Canada's constitution as its own and not subject to the British Parliament. He made no-fault divorce and homosexuality legal. He instituted the official policy of multiculturalism, which made it a matter of law that Canadian citizens were encouraged to practice their religions and maintain their identities. Pierre Trudeau might have been the most important architect of the Liberal Canada, but he was also tough as hell. He famously invoked the Emergency War Measures Act against separatist terrorists in 1970, suspending civil liberties and bringing in the military. When asked by journalists how far he was willing to go, he said, "Just watch me." Pierre Trudeau knew that the liberal order demands forceful and practical, and occasionally ugly, defense. His son now seems to believe that telling people to be nice to one another will do. This weakness not only threatens the multicultural society his father founded, it threatens progressive values around the world. For many, Canada seemed a lone candle alight for the values of pluralism and liberalism as they have been extinguished elsewhere in the world. Justin Trudeau does not have to call an election until 2025. He won elections against the odds before, but time is not on his side. It's not Pierre Trudeau's world anymore. It doesn't much look like Justin Trudeau's either.
Thank you, Howard. Colleges have gone off the deep end. There is a way out. Opinion by opinion columnist David French. I had my head in a law book when I first heard the drums. That was the sound of the first campus protest I'd ever experienced. I'd come to Harvard Law School in the fall of 1991 as a graduate of a small, very conservative Christian college in Nashville. Many of my college classmates had passionate religious and political commitments, but street protest was utterly alien to the Christian culture of the school. We were rule followers, and public protest looked a bit too much like anarchy for our tastes. But Harvard was different. The law school was every bit as progressive as my college was conservative, and protest was part of the fabric of student life, especially then. This is the era when a writer for GQ magazine, John Sedgwick, called the law school Beirut on the Charles, because it was torn apart by disputes over race and sex. There were days when campus protests were festive, almost celebratory. There were other days when the campus was seething with rage and fury. That first protest was in support of faculty diversity, and it was relatively benign. I walked outside and followed the sound of the drums. A group of roughly 100 protesters were marching in front of the law school library, and soon they were joined by an allied group of similar size from Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. I watched as they danced, sang, and listened to speeches by student activists and sympathetic professors. That first protest had an angry edge, but it was also completely peaceful and endlessly fascinating to a kid from a small town in Kentucky who'd never seen a drum circle before. But things soon got worse, much worse. Protests got more unruly, and student activists got more aggressive. The entire campus was in a state of conflict. In Sedgwick's words, students were waging holy war on one another. Small groups of students occupied administrative offices, and angry activists shouted down their political opponents in class and often attempted to intimidate them outside of class. I was shouted down repeatedly, and twice I received disturbing handwritten notes in my campus mailbox in response to my anti-abortion advocacy. My student peers told me to go die. Watching the protests and experiencing the shoutdowns changed the course of my career. I was both enthralled by the power of protest and repulsed by the efforts to silence dissenters. Given the immense cultural influence of American higher education, I agreed with the Supreme Court's famous words in the 1957 case Sweezy v. New Hampshire. Teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study, and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die. Those words, combined with my own negative encounters at Harvard, helped define my legal career. From that point forward, I would defend free speech. It's been more than 30 years since that first campus protest, and over that time I've seen countless protests. I've defended countless protesters, and I've even been protested against at several schools. In the course of those cases and confrontations, I've learned that the issue of campus protest is remarkably complex and that campus culture is at least as important as law and policy in setting the boundaries of debate. There is profound confusion on campus right now around the distinctions between free speech, civil disobedience, and lawlessness. At the same time, some schools also seem confused about their fundamental academic mission. Does the university believe it should be neutral toward campus activism, protecting it as an exercise of the students' constitutional rights and academic freedoms, but not cooperating with student activists to advance shared goals? Or does it incorporate activism as part of the educational process itself, including by coordinating with the protesters and encouraging their activism? The simplest way of outlining the ideal university policy toward protest is to say that it should protect free speech, respect civil disobedience, and uphold the rule of law. That means universities should protect the rights of students and faculty on a viewpoint-neutral basis, and they should endeavor to make sure that every member of the campus community has the same access to campus facilities and resources. That also means showing no favoritism between competing ideological groups in access to classrooms, in the imposition of campus penalties, and in access to educational opportunities. All groups should have equal rights to engage in the full range of protected speech, including by engaging in rhetoric that's hateful to express and painful to hear. Public chants like "globalize the intifada" may be repugnant to many ears, but they're clearly protected by the First Amendment at public universities and by policies protecting free speech and academic freedom at most private universities. Still, reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions are indispensable in this context. Time, place, and manner restrictions are content-neutral legal rules that enable a diverse community to share the same space and enjoy equal rights. Noise limits can protect the ability of students to study and sleep. Restricting the amount of time any one group can demonstrate on the limited open spaces on campus permits other groups to use the same space. If one group is permitted to occupy a quad indefinitely, for example, then that action by necessity excludes other organizations from the same ground. In that sense, indefinitely occupying a university quad isn't simply a form of expression. It also functions as a form of exclusion. Put most simply, student groups should be able to take turns using public spaces for an equal amount of time and during a roughly similar portion of the day. Civil disobedience is distinct from First Amendment protected speech. It involves both breaking an unjust law and accepting the consequences. There is a long and honorable history of civil disobedience in the United States, but true civil disobedience ultimately honors and respects the rule of law. In a 1965 appearance on Meet the Press, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. described the principle perfectly. When one breaks the law that conscience tells him is unjust, he must do it openly, he must do it cheerfully, he must do it lovingly, he must do it civilly, not uncivilly, and he must do it with a willingness to accept the penalty. But what we're seeing on a number of campuses isn't free expression, nor is it civil disobedience. It's outright lawlessness. No matter the frustration of campus activists or their desire to be heard, true civil disobedience shouldn't violate the rights of others. Indefinitely occupying a quad violates the rights of other speakers to use the same space. Relentless, loud protest violates the rights of students to sleep or study in peace. And when protests become truly threatening or intimidating, they can violate the civil rights of other students, especially if those students are targeted on the basis of their race, sex, color, or national origin. The end result of lawlessness is chaos and injustice. Other students can't speak. Other students can't learn. Teachers and administrators can't do their jobs. In my experience as a litigator, campus chaos is frequently the result of a specific campus culture. Administrators and faculty members will often abandon any pretense of institutional neutrality and either cooperate with their most intense activist students or impose double standards that grant favored constituencies extraordinary privileges. For many administrators, the very idea of neutrality is repugnant. It represents a form of complicity in injustice that they simply can't or won't stomach. So they nurture and support one side. They scorn the opposition, adopting a de facto posture that says, to my friends, everything, for my enemies, the law. I've experienced this firsthand. I vividly remember representing a campus Christian group in a dispute at Tufts University in 2000. The group had been derecognized for requiring that student leaders of their group share that group's traditional sexual ethic, which reserves sex for heterosexual marriage. You might disagree strongly with that view, but granting religious groups the flexibility to impose faith-based requirements on religious leaders fits squarely within the American tradition of free exercise of religion. Tufts is a private university, so it has some flexibility in suppressing religious expression on campus. But it had no excuse for attempting to toss a Christian group from campus at the same time that it permitted acts of intimidation against those Christian students. For example, at the most contentious moment of the dispute, Tufts officials prevented my student clients and me from entering the hearing room where their appeal was being heard, while a crowd of protesters gathered in a darkened hallway, pressed up around us, and herded us into a corner of the hall. There was no campus outrage at this act of intimidation. We saw no administrative response. University complicity in chaos isn't unusual. In a case I worked on when I was a student of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, we discovered that administrators at Washington State University's Pullman campus had actually helped plan a disruptive protest against a play put on by a student director, an intentionally provocative show that mocked virtually every group on campus. University or faculty participation in unlawful protest isn't confined to the cases I worked on. At Oberlin College, administrative facilitation of ugly and defamatory student protests outside a local business ultimately cost the school $36 million in damages. At Columbia, hundreds of sympathetic faculty members staged their own protest in support of the student encampment on the quad, and there are reports that other faculty members have attempted to block members of the media from accessing the student encampment. None of this is new. All of it creates a culture of impunity for the most radical students. Disruptive protesters are rarely disciplined, or they get mere slaps on the wrist. They're hailed as heroes by many of their professors. Administrators look the other way as protesters pitch their tents on the quad, despite clear violations of university policy. Then, days later, those same administrators look at the tent city on campus, wring their hands, and ask, "How did this spiral out of control?" There is a better way. When universities can actually recognize and enforce the distinctions between free speech, civil disobedience, and lawlessness, they can protect both the right of students to protest and the rights of students to study and learn in peace. In March, a small band of pro-Palestinian students at Vanderbilt University in Nashville pushed past a security guard so aggressively that they injured him, walked into a university facility that was closed to protest, and briefly occupied the building. The university had provided ample space for protest, and both pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian students had been speaking and protesting peacefully on campus since October 7th. But these students weren't engaged in free speech, nor were they engaged in true civil disobedience. Civil disobedience does not include assault, and within hours the university shut them down. Three students were arrested in the assault on the security guard, and one was arrested on charges of vandalism. More than 20 students were subjected to university discipline. Three were expelled, and one was suspended. The message was clear. Every student can protest, but protest has to be peaceful and lawful. In taking this action, Vanderbilt was empowered by its posture of institutional neutrality. It does not take sides in matters of public dispute. Its fundamental role is to maintain a forum for speech, not to set the terms of the debate, and certainly not to permit one side to break reasonable rules that protect education and safety on campus. Vanderbilt is not alone in its commitment to neutrality. The University of Chicago has long adhered to the Calvin principles, that's spelled K-A-L-V-E-N, Calvin principles, a statement of university neutrality articulated in 1967 by a committee led by one of the most respected legal scholars of the last century, Harry Calvin, Jr. At their heart, the Calvin principles articulate the view that the instrument of dissent and criticism is the individual faculty member or the individual student. The university is the home and sponsor of critics. It is not itself the critic. It is, to go back once again to the classic phrase, a community of scholars. Contrast Vanderbilt's precise response with the opposing extremes. In response to the chaos at Columbia, the school is finishing the semester with hybrid classes, pushing thousands of students online. The University of Southern California canceled its main stage commencement ceremony, claiming that the need for additional safety measures made the ceremony impractical. At both schools, the inability to guarantee safety and order has diminished the educational experience of their students. While USC and Columbia capitulate, other schools have taken an excessively draconian approach. Governor Greg Abbott of Texas posted on X, "Students joining in hate-filled anti-Semitic protests at any public college or university in Texas should be expelled." On April 25th, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression sent a forceful letter to the president of the University of Texas at Austin, condemning the display of force on campus. UT Austin, it wrote, at the direction of Governor Greg Abbott, appears to have preemptively banned peaceful pro-Palestinian protesters due solely to their views rather than for any actionable misconduct. At Emory University, footage emerged of police tackling a female professor who posed no obvious danger to the police or anyone else. Protests are almost always tense, and there is often no easy way to physically remove protesters from campus. But the video footage of the confrontation with the professor was shocking. It's hard to conceive of a justification for the violent police response. At this moment, one has the impression that university presidents at several universities are simply hanging on, hoping against hope that they can manage the crisis well enough to survive the school year and close the dorms, and praying that passions cool over the summer. That is a vain hope. There is no indication that the war in Gaza, or certainly the region, will be over by the fall. it's quite possible that Israel will be engaged in full-scale war on its northern border against Hezbollah. And the United States will be in the midst of a presidential election that could be every bit as contentious as the 2020 contest. But summer does give space for a reboot. It allows universities to declare unequivocally that they will protect free speech, respect peaceful civil disobedience, and uphold the rule of law by protecting the campus community from violence and chaos. Universities should not protect students from hurtful ideas, but they must protect their ability to peacefully live and learn in a community of scholars. There is no other viable alternative.
Thank you, Tom. Harvey Weinstein and the Limits of She Said, She Said, She Said, by Jessica Bennett, a contributing editor in Opinion, where she writes about gender, politics, and personalities. I often wake up these days feeling as though I'm living in an upside-down world. Thursday was one such morning. Just as Donald Trump prepared to spend another day in a Manhattan criminal court to face charges related to hush money paid to a porn star he allegedly had sex with, in the same spot where Harvey Weinstein was convicted of rape 4 years ago, Mr. Weinstein's New York conviction was overturned. The decision was determined by a single vote by a majority female panel of judges who ruled that the trial court judge had improperly allowed testimony from accusers who weren't part of the charges, compromising Mr. Weinstein's right to a fair trial. Those following Mr. Weinstein's legal battles always knew there was a possibility that his conviction would be thrown out on appeal. But the nature of the decision and its focus on several women who testified that Mr. Weinstein had assaulted them, even though none of those allegations had led to charges, revealed something that unsettled me. Until Thursday, it seemed that we had entered a new age of accountability, legal and social, not just for Mr. Weinstein, but also for the abusers who'd come after him. Even as the Me Too movement fell short in some ways, the Weinstein case felt like a cultural marker, an Arthur's sword in the stone moment, in which something irreversible happened. The monster of Me Too had been vanquished, and it changed something about the way we understood vulnerability and power. And then suddenly it didn't. To be clear, Thursday's ruling will not spring Mr. Weinstein from behind bars. He already faced an additional 16 years from a separate conviction in California, and he may be sent there to serve out that sentence. But in establishing the limits of these so-called prior bad act witnesses, an attempt by the prosecution in the case to show a pattern of coercion, the ruling did something else. It highlighted the striking gap between how we've come to believe women inside the courtroom and outside it. One of the lasting and mostly positive outcomes of the Me Too movement, thanks in large part to Mr. Weinstein's accusers speaking out, has been the way that public perception of sexual assault has shifted. Cases that were once dismissed as he said, she said, were suddenly made collective as women all over the globe came forward to proclaim they too, sparking a global reckoning. Today, the idea of believability in sexual assault cases has come to be synonymous with numbers. An army of voices joining to support a claim is how we come to believe that a woman is telling the truth. It is also, by the way, how we as journalists have learned to present those cases,
detailing patterns, repetitions, and often decades' worth of paper trails. I arrived at the Times in 2017, just days before my colleagues Jody Cantor and Megan Twohey began to publish groundbreaking charges against Mr. Weinstein. Accusations against him had been floating around Hollywood for years, but it was only through intensive corroboration, a paper trail, and, importantly, the voices of multiple women that Ms. Cantor and Ms. Twohey were able to establish a pattern. The women of the Weinstein story became believable to the public because there were simply too many of them, with too many similar details, over too many years, for us not to believe. Around 100 more women came forward with stories of sexual misconduct by Mr. Weinstein in the aftermath of that first article by Ms. Cantor and Ms. Twohey. The book and movie that followed were titled, aptly, She Said, an homage to that chorus of voices. And yet inside the courtroom, as I reluctantly learned this week, the opposite can be true. She said, she said, she said, she said, can unravel a prosecution. Put bluntly, our court system has not fully caught up to culture when it comes to understanding sexual violence. On its face, the veritable tsunami of damning evidence against Mr. Weinstein and others exposed for wrongdoing seemed to solve a problem that activists had labored over for decades. How do you combat the he said, she said nature of sexual assault cases? While Mr. Weinstein's accusers could, as Ms. Cantor wrote, fill a courtroom, and the women who proclaimed Me Too in their wake could populate a small country, much of Mr. Weinstein's appeal rested precisely on the argument that those voices ended up hurting, not helping the case. As I read and reread the ruling, I realized the same swelling chorus of victims that made it possible for Mr. Weinstein to be held to account in the court of public opinion had somehow saved him in the court of law. What I tell my students is to think about the courtroom as an alternate universe, said the legal scholar Deborah Turkheimer, when I called her to ask if I was crazy not to have seen this coming. A former Manhattan prosecutor and the author of the book Credible, Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers, she explained that, indeed, there is a tension between the principles of criminal prosecution, which tend to limit a defendant's other bad acts or past behavior, and public perception of a credible allegation. It is frustrating, of course, that the very reason there are so many women available to speak out is that the legal system has failed them from the start. In the Weinstein case, many of the accusations were about sexual harassment, which is a civil, not criminal, violation. Others fell beyond the statute of limitations. But the legal system is not adequately set up to prosecute people accused of being serial sexual predators like Mr. Weinstein. It is, rightly, supposed to protect innocent people from being judged by their past behavior. A person who has stolen once is not a lifelong thief, for one. But sex crimes are more slippery than that, with patterns and power dynamics and less likelihood witnesses, which can leave prosecutors in a catch-22. To any casual observer, Mr. Weinstein's history of accusations of abuse seems as though it should be admissible, and yet it was not. Ms. Turkheimer noted that the closeness of the appeals ruling, as well as the back and forth from the judges, could, and perhaps should, revive debate about whether the rules for such convictions need to be updated. In federal court, she said, there is a carve-out for sexual assault that gives more leeway to prosecutors. And yet, as it turns out, in some states, including California, where Mr. Weinstein's lawyers plan to appeal next, they already have been. Shortly after Mr. Weinstein was convicted in California in 2022, the former prosecutors Jane Manning and Tali Farhadian Weinstein argued in a guest essay for The Times that while trials should hold people accountable for bad acts, not bad reputations, the time had come to think about sex crimes differently. Prosecutors should be able to argue something that tracks with common sense, that past predatory acts show a pattern of behavior, they wrote. If Me Too could move the cultural conversation beyond a single case of he said, she said, isn't it time that the legal system allowed the same? On Thursday, a few miles north of the criminal courthouse where Mr. Weinstein was convicted 4 years ago, the activist Tarana Burke appeared alongside Ashley Judd, one of Mr. Weinstein's accusers, and urged the public to remember that movements like Me Too are long and strategic. Even a decade ago, Ms. Burke said, we could not get a man like Harvey Weinstein into the courtroom. The bad thing about survivors is there are so many of us, she told the crowd. But the good thing about survivors is that there are so many of us.
Thank you, Howard. Finally, from the letters to the editor, R.E., Can Those on the Left Be Happy? By Ross Douthat, column, April 7th. Mr. Douthat thinks, citing no evidence, that people on the left are, by nature, unhappier than moderates or conservatives, in part because he thinks we don't believe in God anymore. The left is not, by nature, unhappy. We are often brutally honest with ourselves and unavoidably empathetic to the plights of those who suffer. I wear those traits as a badge of honor. If we feel more unhappy these days, it's not because it's in our genes. It's because we see the truths of our world, the radical disruptions from technology, the very real threats of climate change, the distortions of our economy that leave so many behind, and the threat of political violence and fascism on our doorstep, thanks to the God-fearing right. We see it all with clarity and are therefore motivated to change it. That letter is from Rebecca Spence of New Providence, New Jersey.
Tom, thank you. Folks, Charlie has given me the circle in the air signal, which means it's time to wrap things up. Folks, it's been our pleasure today to share with you excerpts from the New York Times opinion section. Tom and I expect to be here at this same time next week. So for now, this is Howard Tankersley and
Tom Davis
saying farewell. Please join us next week and have a good Sunday.